Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Jessica Hergert. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Miami, Florida for a State of the Science Summit on gastrointestinal malignancies. At the meeting, faculty from the Florida Society of Clinical Oncology discussed the novel agents that are generating excitement in advanced hepatocellular carcinoma and cholangiocarcinoma, and novel therapies and strategies that are propelling progress in gastric cancer. Moreover, panelists shed light on the use of molecular testing in colorectal cancer and the current and investigational treatment strategies in the relapsed refractory setting. Other key topics included remaining challenges with staging in pancreatic cancer, unanswered questions in the localized setting, and the benefits of olaparib in the metastatic setting. First, the chair of the meeting, Atif Hussain, MD, sat down with us to discuss how the treatment of patients with hepatocellular carcinoma and cholangiocarcinoma has evolved in recent years. According to Hussain, who is a hematologist-oncologist at Memorial Healthcare System, treatment for patients with advanced hepatocellular carcinoma continues to evolve with several promising combinations, such as atezolizumab plus bevacizumab, pembrolizumab and lenvatinib, and nivolumab plus ipilimumab. In cholangiocarcinoma, novel treatments such as ivosidenib are just beginning to emerge. Listen on to hear more.
It is really exciting to talk about hepatocellular carcinoma now, what we refer to as liver cancer. A couple of years ago, this conversation would have lasted a couple of minutes and would have said, that's it. And now actually it is very complicated. It's becoming very exciting, especially for our patients. Liver cancer is almost an epidemic in Asia and some countries because of the incidence of hepatitis B. But it's becoming a problem here because of hepatitis C too. But we've come really a long way. The first trial published, that we call the SHARP trial, was published almost now 10 years ago, and it was a breakthrough. Sorafenib improved overall survival in patients with inoperable hepatocellular carcinoma. Wow. We only had a couple of chemo drugs that didn't work. We used them out of desperation. Therefore, that really opened the floodgates to how we manage liver cancer. It's a complicated disease because you are really treating two diseases in one. You are treating the liver cirrhosis and the underlying cause, and then you are treating the cancer that's secondary to that cause. Therefore, you need to be careful what you can and can't do with this disease and include a lot of people in the care of these patients. The Empower 150 showing that the combination of atezolizumab and bevacizumab was superior to sorafenib in frontline therapy. And it seems it met its both co-primary endpoints, progression-free survival and overall survival. It showed that those differences not only statistically significant, but clinically significant too. I think it's going to change the whole field of hepatocellular carcinoma. This is the original combination immune therapy that I actually started doing these studies like 16 years ago with ipilimumab in malignant melanoma. And the two drugs made a lot of sense. Why? Because one of them is a checkpoint inhibitor that inhibits PD-1, and one is a cytotoxic T lymphocyte antigen 4. Therefore, it makes sense for us to remove two breaks that the immune system puts on itself, which is the CTLA-4, and the second, the break that the cancer puts on the immune system. The problem with that combination, although it's very effective, is the side effects. It tends to become a little bit more, although we have become very smart about the doses, what we use, and ipilimumab is only four doses, and then you continue with nivo. But this is really a combination that started the whole thing. And in selected patients with good performance status, it's very manageable side effects, and we know how to do that. Cholangiocarcinoma is what hepatocellular carcinoma was a few years ago. It's a disease nobody really wanted to treat. It's very sick patients. It's more than one disease. I mean, when we talk cholangiocarcinoma, is it intrahepatic, extrahepatic? Is it gallbladder? And it's not just one disease. But But there is something that we have learned about cholangiocarcinoma, and that is there is so many mutations. Truly, of all the cancers, and I treat multiple cancers, cholangiocarcinoma has the most known mutations. The problem is we have not been able to target those mutations.
Afterward, we spoke with Mike Kuznir, MD, who said that the influx of novel agents such as ramucirumab, regorafenib, and tipifarnib is rapidly changing the gastric cancer treatment landscape. Additionally, the potential to combine these drugs with immunotherapy may yield significant benefit for these patients. In our interview, Kuznir, the co-director of gastrointestinal malignancies at Mount Sinai Medical Center, discusses the evolving gastric cancer treatment paradigm.
We had the initial disappointment of bevacizumab, and seeing now an antiangiogenic be able to make it in gastric cancer and be able to make it on the front and second line, as well as starting to see the data even of individual therapy, as much as that's not as exciting as the combination therapy, it is an option. And mostly when you practice in a setting of patients that have a borderline poor performance status, it's an option. So the ramucirumab data, it's actually interesting even to be considered in different patient populations as well. So regorafenib in gastric cancer still is in early phases of development. We're still not completely sure where it's going to end up fitting. It's a drug that certainly has a slight more toxicity, even to the point that in colorectal cancer, the redose trials and some of the different alternative dosing regimens have been up and coming and probably adopted by most of the people around the world. In gastric cancer, we're still holding into the previous arena, and we're actually awaiting the more confirmatory trials to see that regorafenib indeed is going to be breaking the ceiling also in subsequent lines in gastric cancer. So with gastric cancer, the beauty is that it appears to be that there's a benefit in a large proportion of the patients, which is where the disappointments have come in some of the other GI malignancies, where the benefit was in the minority and actually even a minute number of patients. In gastric cancer, the number of patients that are deriving benefit being mediated by the PD-L1 expression, as well as the Epstein-Barr expression in gastric cancer and some of the other differential types. Even on the diffuse types, it appears to be that there's some preferential benefit that ends up getting us a good number of patients that are going to benefit from PD-L1 inhibitors in gastric cancer. I think that that's what we're seeing. The data from lung cancer, now the data that we're seeing from triple negative breast cancer, and we could continue to go into all the other different malignancies. We're seeing that the single agent therapy benefits a small percentage super selected population, but then subsequently when you're able to get more of the patients, maybe by just breaking down the cells, exposing the antigen epitopes that the immune system will recognize and end up going against them, might be more beneficial. And I think that that's what we're going to be seeing more in the future. We've made strides in getting HER2 testing on a molecular level and not just immunohistochemistry, but I do think that it's at a level that we should be getting even more testing than what it's done. The problem is that the different targets that we have for gastric cancer have not been the most beneficials, and even on that setting, the HER2 second and subsequent lines have failed miserably, and we would hope that we would see more benefit when we have not done so.
Single gene testing is no longer sufficient in metastatic colorectal cancer, Michael Wolfovich, MD, told us when he stopped by. Now, broad molecular testing should be done to screen for BRAF mutations, HER2 alterations, and microsatellite instability, in addition to KRAS mutations. Notably, the test results can indicate a patient's prognosis as well as inform treatment decisions. The results of molecular testing could also impact sequencing strategies in the second and third line setting, making testing a necessity upon diagnosis. Listen on to hear Wolfovich, the medical director of the Sickle Cell Disease and Gynecology Oncology Programs at Memorial Healthcare System, discuss the utility of broad molecular profiling in patients with metastatic colorectal cancer.
So many times when we encounter a new colorectal cancer patient, we don't know how to approach this patient. So the idea is to be able to identify what it's needed to treat the patient the best way. So which tests should be included in the next generation sequencing testing, molecular testing, I think for some of the oncologists in the community, they're just used to the old, you know, molecular testing, which used to be only the KRAS mutation, but we have so many newer tests, more extensive testing that make it, you know, that we need to implement for these patients, you know, BRAF mutations, HER2 mutations as well, and obviously the microsatellite instability for the immunotherapy. So now we need to do a more extensive profiling because the patients, instead of having one or two lines of chemotherapy, now we can extend 3, 4, or 5 lines of treatment as well. So, you know, for clinical practice, most of the patients, they get started on, you know, standard chemotherapy, which is either FOLFOX or CAPOX plus minus Avastin. And if the patient has a wild type for the KRAS mutation, then they'll be able to receive either cetuximab or panitumumab. However, for, you know, more, you know, second, third, or fourth lines, that's when we're looking more into these mutations, you know, for the BRAF mutation, for the HER2 mutation. However, they also have some implications for prognosis as well. So for some patients, we want to know ahead of time in that regards. And, you know, at the same time, you know, going back to the left versus right sidedness of the colon cancer, you know, we know for certain patients we shouldn't start with, you know, even if they are KRAS wild type, we should not start these patients on treatment for that. You know, in general, all these mutations, including the MSI, you know, they are rare. Most of them, they are even less than 10%, just generally speaking. Now, once we encounter MSI, if there are high, you know, microsatellite instability high, we know that these patients will respond to immunotherapy in many of these cases. However, this is not one of the first lines that we, you know, we start with. Except in select patients, maybe elderly patients who are frail, you know, we may consider it. Generally speaking, we use either nivolumab or pembrolizumab, you know, for the treatment, you know, for the patients that are MSI high. You know, it's early on that we're getting this data. You know, even when the study initially was presented, we didn't even know in the study how many of these patients had the KRAS mutation and how many did not. You know, after a couple of years, you know, they start presenting more of the data. As I mentioned before, you know, there is prognostic significance, there is treatment implications. So, you know, for many of these patients, you know, before we didn't take into account, we used to treat all colorectal cancer patients the same way. Now, it makes a difference identifying if they were left versus right to decide if we should start these patients on cetuximab versus Avastin, you know. So that's one of the main things that, you know, come into account for the staging and for the treatment identification.
When we sat down with A. Craig Lockhart, MD, MHS, he said that the explosion of immunotherapy in the field of oncology has spread to the colorectal cancer treatment paradigm. Now, investigators are evaluating combination approaches with this class of agents and other novel drugs to elicit greater responses in patients with relapsed refractory disease. Moreover, in pancreatic cancer, he said that the treatment arsenal for those with metastatic disease has expanded to include frontline maintenance therapy with the PARP inhibitor olaparib, as it recently received the green light from the FDA in December 2019. In our interview, Lockhart, a professor and the Associate Director for Regional and Strategic Clinical Research Affiliations at Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center of the University of Miami Health System, discussed the future of immunotherapy in colorectal cancer, the treatment options available to patients with pancreatic cancer, and how the introduction of olaparib in the frontline maintenance setting may benefit patients.
Well, everything now is immunotherapy. If you look at either of those agents, I mean, there's data for chemotherapy agents with immunotherapy, I mean, affecting the proteins that are, genetics and then the proteins that are expressed on cancer cells, and so that anything that alters the immune milieu may be able to affect immunotherapy. So again, that's where everybody would want to go, with some kind of combination with one of those therapies and maybe some kind of immune therapy in some shape or fashion. There is a fair amount of evidence for the tyrosine kinase inhibitors having potential interactions, again, changing the expression of PD-L1, at least in some other cancers. And so that would be the obvious place to go as first is with immunotherapy with one of those agents, or some combination of one of those agents, something else, and immunotherapy. So then bringing those agents further forward, again, one of the studies, the reverse study with cetuximab, if cetuximab is given after regorafenib, I think most of us haven't been doing that in practice. Again, so it's sequencing, I would say, looking at different combinations and then trying to find other spaces where those medications may fit in better. But again, we're not going to be able to make a lot of those decisions until we know about biomarkers that can help us decide which patients are going to be the right ones to select so that we can change these strategies for use of those medications. Again, immunotherapy is the single most important therapeutic strategy that has come along in oncology, probably period. And so I do think that trying to make those drugs work for more patients, make it more applicable across the board, I think is a good strategy. Now, trying to figure out how to do that, trying to get these cold tumors hot or tumors to express more PD-L1 or to alter the types of proteins that these tumors are expressing, I think is a reasonable strategy. Now, there are lots of ways that you can alter protein expression, whether it's radiation, chemotherapy, or some other combination strategies. I do think that's probably where I would like to think that we'd go next. For pancreas cancer, again, it's a very difficult cancer to begin with. Patients, they can present with a constellation of symptoms. They can present with alterations in their liver function testing, including elevated bilirubin, and a lot of those things can dictate the kinds of treatments that we need to give to these patients. We have two frontline strategies, essentially FOLFIRINOX and gemcitabine with nab-paclitaxel. We have essentially two strategies there. How we pick tends to be somewhat arbitrary, but people do have their own reasons for why they pick certain things. They can look at age, they can look at performance status. Bilirubin is a common way that we pick that because FOLFIRINOX, in general, in some of the clinical trials, was not given to patients who had bilirubins greater than 1.5, and so there can see some different strategies there. Now, with the recent BRCA 1-2 germline status, those patients are supposed to be more responsive to platinum agents, and so maybe you might consider FOLFIRINOX in that setting rather than gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. So there are some reasons that we make those decisions. There is some data that maybe as a backbone for clinical trials, if you want to add another drug onto the frontline therapy, that gemcitabine plus nab-paclitaxel might be a better backbone, but again, I've done clinical trials where you've added to either one of them. So it's not, FOLFIRINOX can be a backbone for clinical trials. What I'd like to establish is that we need to be able to choose our patients better as far as which regimen's concerned. And then what you pick up front leads to what you're gonna pick second line. Not all patients with pancreatic cancer get onto second line therapy, but a substantial percentage of them do. And so whatever you're doing up front, you need to be cognizant of what you're thinking in the second line setting. If you pick FOLFIRINOX, you may be considering gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel in the second line. If you pick gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel first line, then what are you thinking second line? Probably something 5-FU based, whether it's 5-FU with NALIRI, which is our nanoliposomal irinotecan, do that, or whether we want to try FOLFIRINOX in the second line setting. But those are the strategies that you need to think about. What do you want to do first line? And if you need to be thinking, considering how often pancreas cancer patients, where the tumors become resistant to therapy, and we're going to have to try second line therapy, you need to be thinking further down the road as far as what your second line options are going to be. And then we do have the recent data with olaparib in the patients who are BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutated, again, representing a relatively small percentage of pancreas cancer patients. But again, those are patients where you can consider a maintenance strategy so you can reduce the toxicity in these patients who might be on chemotherapy for a little bit longer term than we're used to seeing in patients with pancreatic cancer.
Although four imaging modalities are available to detect pancreatic cancer, there are remaining challenges regarding early identification of the disease, as well as making screening more cost-effective, explained Alfonso Ribeiro, MD. Moreover, he told us that the definition of borderline resectable in pancreatic cancer shifts depending on the institution, creating a lack of standardization with regard to staging this patient population. Listen on to hear Ribeiro, Medical Director of Advanced Endoscopy and Gastroenterology at Memorial Healthcare System, discuss novel imaging modalities, as well as challenges and future goals for treatment in pancreatic cancer.
There are four imaging modalities mainly that are available. The most common used one are CT scan, which is usually the first one, and then endoscopic ultrasound. This can be complemented by a PET scan in some cases, or a MRI if needed, but not all patients will need all four imaging tests. Usually just a CT scan and endoscopic ultrasound will be what will be necessary for most patients. This is a, somewhat subjective definition, and it changes from group by group or institution by institution, but in general, this involves a large group of patients, the majority of them, who we think will not have an R0 resection if taken to surgery. There are patients who have a higher risk of residual disease after surgery, so those are we classify as borderline resection. Usually involves patients who have a lot of tumor contact with the vein or some contact with the artery that we don't see a clear tissue plane on those blood vessels. So instead of taking a patient to surgery and running the risk of having residual disease, we now group them on a borderline resectable and give them treatment before surgery. And there are patients we may want to give them chemotherapy, but they can't due to other conditions like renal failure or advanced age. But on the other hand, there are patients who may seem resectable, but for example, on endoscopic ultrasound, they have multiple lymph nodes or they have a very high C99, which means that usually this could be systemic disease or metastatic disease even, and those patients are usually benefit from additional therapy, chemotherapy before, treatment before surgery. We're still not great to see, for example, peritoneal disease in any of the imaging modalities. Particularly post-chemotherapy, when you restage a patient, it's very often difficult to make sure that we're seeing is tumor, not dead, necrotic fibrotic tissue. So I think in the future, with more tumor-targeted imaging is where we can actually see if you're dealing with viable tumor, this may be more relevant than just an anatomical imaging that we use nowadays. Yeah, there are challenges with peritoneal disease, with residual disease after chemotherapy, and you know, adenopathy is always a challenge. You know, always we see those nodes very well, even on endoscopic ultrasound. Sometimes there's a large area to cover, and so there, yes, we do have challenges. I think what we're doing, you know, having meetings like that and having surgeons and oncologists together, but a lot of that depends on the skill of your surgeon, how much he's willing to do for that patient, and also depends on the patient characteristics. Can they really withstand an operation that will require arterial reconstruction, you know, many hours of surgery, potential complications? So it's not just the what you see on a CT scan, but also can a patient withstand that operation, that larger operation. But having meetings and have obviously consensus guidelines that we have been developed in 2016, describing the different societies, their different criteria for borderline resectable, I think it's a start.
We closed out the night with Pablo Ferrero, MD, a medical oncologist at Memorial Cancer Institute of Memorial Healthcare System. In our interview, Ferrero said that findings from three key trials have shed light on how to approach neoadjuvant and adjuvant treatment for patients with pancreatic cancer. However, pivotal questions regarding disease biology and the potential role of emerging modalities in the paradigm have yet to be answered. Listen on to hear Ferrero discuss some of the latest developments in pancreatic cancer treatment and the potential role of emerging modalities under exploration.
There are two trials that were presented at the ASCO 2018, and those are the Prodigy 44 trial and the PRIOPANC 1 trial. Now, the Prodigy 44 applies to the adjuvant setting in pancreatic cancer. And that significantly changed the way we treat adjuvant pancreatic cancer because it marked a good standard of care. The PRIOPANC is a trial, it's a European Dutch trial that treated neoadjuvant pancreatic cancer, and the way they put it is to try to prove that neoadjuvant therapy with radiation and chemotherapy is better than adjuvant therapy, and also it's marking a trend to where probably things are going to go in the future. Now, the third trial was presented this year, the APACT trial, and that one is in the adjuvant setting as well, and there are controversies about it, but again, it's probably going to be one of those things that we're going to start using. We use it right now, but we're going to start using it even more if the trial turns out to be what it's supposed to be. It's still, you know, not completed, it's preliminary. Pancreatic cancer in general has been a little bit behind other cancers. And right now things are getting better with molecular profiling. BRCA mutation we were talking about is one of those. Immunotherapy in those who have mismatch repair enzymes and MSI high and other things. I mean, so far in the application of the everyday treatment, things are evolving. and we have to see how it goes. For now, there are a few markers that we can action and treat and use as actionable markers, and therapy is coming, hopefully, for ovarian cancer, which has been delayed as compared to the other ones significantly. It's long awaited, something like this. Anything related to actionable mutations and molecular profiling and you know, and therapeutics, there are several things going on at the research, basic research, and phase one level. We'll see how many of those go through the human application. Sometimes, you know, you get excited and then it doesn't pan out. But hopefully, you know, we'll see. I think the future is going to be in pathways and molecular profiling, and see what are the things that we can action, like in other cancers. That's what you see throughout in other cancers. And you know, for example, lung cancer used to be a very difficult disease to treat 6-7 years ago, and today you have 8-9 options out there. So pancreatic cancer is going. I think we have to just wait a little bit.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for recaps from our State of the Science summits and exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Onc Live is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Onc Live and Onc Live SOSS. On Facebook, like us at Onc Live and Onc Live State of the Science Summit, and follow our Onc Live page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Onc Live On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onc Live On Air.